There is nothing worth living for unless it is worth dying for. My grandmother lived a life devoted to Jesus, and today her talks have been made available in their original form. So you too can be built up through the insights and mysteries God revealed to her throughout her ministry. Now, without further ado, here is Elizabeth Elliot.
Had sort of assumed that I was not going to be doing anything more like this, but it's been very gratifying to know that there's still some people that want to hear some things that I may have to say. So my topic this time is called Servanthood. And I begin with a poem by a woman by the name of Ruth Harms Calkin, B-A-L-K-I-N. You know, Lord, how I serve you with great emotional fervor in the limelight. You know how eagerly I speak for you at the women's club. You know how I effervesce when I promote a fellowship group. You know my genuine enthusiasm at a Bible study. But how would I react, I wonder, if you pointed to a basin of water and asked me to wash the calloused feet of a bent and wrinkled old woman day after day, month after month, in a room where nobody saw and nobody knew? The question to ask ourselves is, do I have a servant heart? The bent and wrinkled old woman reminds me of Mrs. Kershaw, the dear deaf lady who came to our home every day to wash and clean and be a blessing to all of our family. I came across a list of things that she was to do one day. Mother was apparently out for the day and had pointed out to Mrs. Kershaw various things that needed to be done. Mother was always very careful not to try too load of a load on this old lady, but she just seemed to have boundless energy, and often she would go home and find that not only had Mrs. Kershaw done everything on the list, but she had done a lot of things that were not on the list. She loved to make applesauce by the gallon and dozens of brown cookies for us. Well, somewhere in my mother's papers, I found this in Mrs. Kershaw's handwriting of the things that she had done that day. Interspersed between the ironing and the dishwashing and maybe the applesauce making, she had written, rested, and had prayer for all. And that dear lady, she was very humpbacked. She was certainly in her 80s, but always looking around for something more that she could do for the Howard family. And we certainly loved her. One of the tasks that was most important in my mother's mind was that Mrs. Kershaw should go upstairs and talk with Nana, my step-grandmother, who was confined to her room. We children were very remiss in the way that we treated that lady, because she was a very difficult person to get along with and very gloomy. And we really didn't like to go into her room. When Mother encouraged us to do so, I would say, "What in the world am I supposed to talk about? She's not interested in anything." Mother's response was, "Don't worry whether she is interested or not. Just tell her what you have done today." But Mrs. Kershaw would always go up and talk to Nana. Now, it really was hilarious because they were both deaf. They passed like ships in the night. You could overhear Nana say something, and whatever Mrs. Kershaw said had nothing to do with what Nana had said, but the dear lady persisted in bringing sunshine. Mrs. Kershaw never stopped smiling, and my grandmother hardly ever smiled at all. Several times during the day, she would go up and talk to Nana. Mrs. Kershaw would go up to talk to Nana. And I just thought of how we really didn't realize that Mrs. Kershaw was praying for us all along as with the rest of the family. The first time I ever saw her, I had come home from college. Mother had been writing about this lovely old lady who was now working for us. And so when I came home for Christmas vacation, I walked into the kitchen, and here she was, bent, very humpbacked, over the dishpan with her back to me. So I said, "Oh, this must be Mrs. Kershaw, isn't it?" She didn't move a muscle. My sister was standing on the other side of the kitchen, and she said, "She's deaf." And I said, "You mean she can't hear at all?" My sister said, "No." And I said, "Not even if you shout?" Jenny shouted, "Not even if you shout." Well, Mrs. Kershaw didn't budge. And so I went over and tapped her on the shoulder. And she turned around with the most radiant smile that lit up her face. And she said, "Oh, here's the daughter." And she always called me the daughter. I did have a sister also, four brothers. My sister was Ginny, but I was the daughter. And I guess that she had been hearing about me while she was working there during that fall. And here I was with such a wonderful lady with a true servant heart. Once a lady who had been a missionary came to me with a question. She had come back with many years of missionary service and had gone to the pastor of her church and told him that she was available to serve in any way that she could. She said, "Elizabeth, do you know what he asked me to do?" I said, "No." "Well, he asked me to take charge of the nursery." I had explained to him that I have 3 degrees. I have had 15 years of service on the mission field. I have experience. I have taught Bible classes. And he asks me to take charge of the nursery? So I said to this lady, "Well, what did you say?" She said, "I just told him that I did not feel that I could do that." "Then do you know what he asked me?" "He asked me to bake bread for the communion. I don't think he understood the qualifications that I had." "She is asking me what I think she should do?" "Well, she asked the wrong lady." I said, "Go back and tell him that you will be glad to take care of the nursery and you will bake the bread too." She was very hurt. Well, if we ever get the idea that any job is beneath us, we're in trouble, because we have a master who took a towel and got down on his knees and washed the dirty feet of his disciples. It especially moved me to think that Jesus washed the feet of Judas and Peter, knowing that he was going to be betrayed by the one and denied by the other. My second husband, Addison Leach, was the dean of a college. One evening, it was brought to his attention that there was peanut butter and shaving cream all over the walls of a certain men's dormitory. So he made his way over to the dormitory and went down the halls, knocking on doors, asking if anybody knew how peanut butter and shaving cream had gotten onto those walls. Nobody had a clue. And he said, "I had a couple of choices then. We had a wonderful janitor who would do anything for anybody, anytime. I didn't want to take advantage of that man at that hour of the night," he said. "So I decided I could either force the men to come out and clean it up themselves, or I could call the janitor, which I decided I was not going to do. And I didn't do either of those. I went and got a bucket and a brush and started scrubbing the walls." Well, it wasn't very long before heads began, one by one, to pop out of doors. And they saw the dean scrubbing the walls. One after another came along with a brush or a rag and began to help him. And Ad simply used that as an example of the power of servanthood. Such servanthood is the mark of a true leader. I think of my house mother, Miss Cumming, who had come from a very wealthy home in Augusta, Georgia, a home with white columns in the front and many servants in the back. She became a Christian and was disinherited by her very wealthy family. She was a single lady, and like some Southern belles, had been raised to be beautiful and not much of anything else. She didn't have any skills. She had a good classical education, but she certainly had never expected to have to make a living for herself. Well, I don't know what she did before she came to Wheaton to be a house mother in the women's dormitory where I lived. But this lady was a true servant. And she and I, for some reason, became good friends. I being just a kid, and she being a very old lady in my mind. She was a short lady, very dumpy, with a wonderful Georgia accent. She came up about to hear on my arm, and she always called me Betty. Well, my nickname, of course, has always been Betty with people that know me, but she could say it with that Georgia accent, calling me Betty. Betty was my name back in those days, but of course a Georgian can string something out and make 2 or 3 syllables where there are only 2. We used to walk to church every Sunday morning because she was my Sunday school teacher, and I got to know her very well. And she even told me that she felt as though I was a friend and didn't think of me as just a kid. We had a wonderful relationship, and I was greatly blessed. I poured out my troubles to her sometimes, and we would pray together, and once in a while she would share some of her own difficulties in the dormitory. One day when I went in, she said to me with this charming way that she had of clasping her very ample bosom, she said, "Oh, Betty,
I came to Wheaton to be a spiritual counselor, but here I am carrying mops and toilet paper across the campus.
Now, that made a tremendous impression on me, because I knew what her background was, and I knew that she had never carried mops and toilet paper in her life. She was a spiritual counselor, of course, to me and to several hundred other girls. Yet the very fact that she was willing to carry the mops and the toilet paper tremendously enhanced the effectiveness of that message of her spiritual counseling. Years later, my husband Ad and I went to visit her in Florida, in her retirement home. I reminded her of what she had said to me that day, and she clasped her bosom, and she said, "Oh, Betty, did I really say that?" I said, "Yes, you did. I remember exactly what you said, and I want you to know what it meant to me." I explained to her how much more her spiritual counseling meant to me because she had the humility to carry the mops and toilet paper for his glory. Then in her sweet southern way, she said, "Oh, Betty, just think of the mercy of God that he allowed me to carry mops and toilet paper for his glory." Now that's servanthood. The first verse of John 13 is so tremendously revelatory of the meaning of what is to follow. It was just before the Passover feast, and Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to his Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. The passage reminds us that Jesus was well aware of his origin and his destiny, because he knew that. He knew that nothing would change where he came from or where he was going. He had the strength and the grace to get up from the meal, take off his outer clothing, wrap a towel around his waist, and proceed to pour water into the basin and wash the feet of his disciples. John 8:14 is another verse that shows us Jesus' awareness of who he was. "Even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid, for I know where I came from and where I am going," Jesus said. He knew the source of his authority. He was not depending upon himself. He did only the things that he saw the Father do. He spoke the words that he heard the Father say. He received these things from his Father, and he received on the occasion of the Passover feast the strength and the grace to take the position of the lowest servant in the Eastern household, the one who did the washing of feet. So Jesus poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand." And Peter, impulsive and sympathetic in ways that you and I would have probably been also, said, "Lord, you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, going to the other extreme, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he said. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, the servant is not greater than his master." Romans 12:16 says, "Be of the same mind toward one another. Mind not high things, condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits." In other words, be willing to do menial work. I deplore a television commercial from years gone by
It started out with a woman saying, if there's one job I hate, it's cleaning toilets. And you know what? I don't do it anymore. And she goes on to talk about the blue stuff that you can put in the toilet tank. Now, I'm not telling you that there's anything wrong with putting the blue stuff in there, but what I do deplore is the attitude that you hate the work that you have to do. Be willing to do menial work. Don't hate it. When you meet children or young people who hate work, it will be because of an attitude from their parents. Somehow or other, they've been given the idea that being a TGIF person, thank God it is Friday, and a Blue Monday kind of person. That whole frame of mind would be absolutely foreign to a jungle Indian. They worked, of course, every day, 7 days a week. They never made any big deal about the rigorous labor that they had to put in every day of their lives in order to survive. The Alka men would leave the clearing every morning about 6 o'clock. If it wasn't absolutely pouring rain, and they wouldn't be back until 5 or sometimes 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and they probably would have run or walked 30 miles or so looking for something to eat for their families. They went out separately. They never went out together because you don't hunt together with blowguns and spears. The women went out as soon as they had taken care of the babies and fed the small children and had eaten whatever might be left over for them. Then they went out to work in the plantation all day, every day. I never saw an Alka woman come back with a tremendously heavy 50 or 60 pound basket on her back, full of manioc and plantains and other food, perhaps a baby on her hip and a machete in her hand. And I have never in my life heard an Indian woman say, "Whew, what a day." They would come back with mud almost from head to toe, having worked and sweated all day long, and would walk into the house, stoop down, take the band off their head so that they could drop the basket onto the floor behind them, and set to work stirring up the fire, cooking the food, and very calmly and quietly doing the things that needed to be done before they went to bed. Let's think about the attitudes that we have towards the work that we have to do. And then ask ourselves a question that Ruth Harms Calkin asked in her poem. What if I had to do something in a room where nobody saw and nobody knew? Often when a conference is over, there's a long list of volunteers who have helped, who are then recognized for their service. The thought has occurred, would there be as many volunteers if there was to be no recognition of each? As Ruth Calkins writes, where nobody saw and nobody knew. Why did Jesus do what he did? It was to show the full extent of his love. Jesus was headed for the crucifixion. Wouldn't you think that that would be sufficient evidence of his love? When his disciples learned what had happened, they did not know at that point what was ahead of them. But you and I are not going to be crucified, literally, and probably most of them were not either. Tradition tells us that some of them were. Crucifixion is one thing. Washing dirty feet is something very different. I think that it's significant that Jesus wanted to give them an example of something that anybody could do anytime without being sung as heroes. Jesus' crucifixion, which is the final and irrefutable proof of his love, was not the only thing that demonstrated what that love meant. The scene at the Last Supper was in order to show the full extent of his love. He did this humble task for his beloved disciples who had disappointed him so many times and were going to disappoint him much more on the next day. He did it even though he was their Lord and Master. That's the thing that's important here, because he was not counting on the fact that he was Lord and Master. He was taking a position below them, showing the true meaning of humility and the willingness to do whatever needs to be done. Let us never think that any job is too low for us. In our culture, we don't have to wash people's feet, since we don't walk on dusty roads in sandals very often. There are courtesies which are recognized. If someone drops in to see you, you immediately put the kettle on and offer them a hot or a cold drink. These are recognized courtesies.
Amy Carmichael, a great missionary to India, used to say, there is no calculating the value of a missionary who will come to do whatever needs to be done. There is no calculating the value of a missionary who will come to do whatever needs to be done. Anything that needs to be done. I hear sad stories about the attrition rate of missionaries. Sometimes it's because they felt that their talents or their gifts or their calling was not adequately appreciated. They didn't get the position they had hoped for. I would like to ask, so what else is new? Is there any missionary that has ever done exactly what they thought they were supposed to do? I went to Ecuador with the hope that I was to be a linguist, since that was the gift that I believed God had given me. God had called me to the foreign mission field, and he had led me to Ecuador in answer to my prayers. Although I did linguistic work in three different languages for various reasons, all of it went down the drain. There is nobody using any of the stuff that I did then, nor has there ever been since way back in the 1960s. But that doesn't mean that God did not accept my service. God's will is always different from what we think, always bigger than what we think, and probably more difficult than what we expect, but ultimately far more glorious than we could ever predict. The job is done for Jesus, not for somebody else. So in this act of love and humility, Jesus was asking his disciples to take up the cross. He showed them the simple and humble ways of doing that. Whatever cuts across your tastes or preferences or desires is the cross in some form. And we need to learn to recognize the crosses as they come without dramatizing them. Let's also look squarely at the truth of it. It is a cross because it cuts across my human preferences. And someone has said, when the will of God cuts across the will of man, somebody has to die. When the will of God cuts across the will of man, somebody has to die. It is my chance for a small death. Paul said that he died daily. He died 1,000 deaths. We talk about dying 1,000 deaths, and it may be at times literally true. But if we are to follow Jesus Christ, there will be many opportunities to take up a cross. Most of them will be mundane. They are not things that anybody else is going to notice for which you are going to receive any kudos. Any mother keeping a home knows only too well the normal everyday routine: washing, ironing, cleaning, cooking, etc. A man thinking of his job will realize most of what he does is a repeat process of some of the same old stuff. Listen to these words by Ugo Bassi. Measure thy life by loss and not by gain, not by the wine drunk, but by the wine poured forth. For love's strength standeth in love's sacrifice, and whoso suffereth most hath most to give. So how could Jesus do what he did? He could do that because he knew his origin and his destiny. And so do we. We know our origin. We know our destiny if we are Christians. Jesus had total security of his place in the Father's love. He had no fear. He knew his Father's sovereign rule over all. He could do it because he knew it did not jeopardize his position as Lord and Master. Miss Cumming, that little lady that I told you about, knew that to carry mops and toilet paper did not jeopardize her position as a spiritual counselor. But it never occurred to her that it would indeed enhance her position. Let's never be afraid that our position is going to be jeopardized if we do what God tells us to do. When Amy Carmichael, whose name I mentioned earlier, went to India, she had a very effective ministry for the first 7 or 8 years as an itinerant evangelist. She had a small band of godly Indian women who traveled with her. They traveled by bullock cart, a most uncomfortable method of travel, which Lars and I tried for about 10 minutes when we were in India. They traveled in that fashion and tented in villages. They would seek to reach the women who are in the inner courts of these Hindu homes, women who had never been reached with the gospel by anyone else. In time, Amy learned of the secret traffic of taking little girls and boys to be used for immoral purposes in the Hindu temples. She prayed that God would enable her to rescue some of these children. And God did that in a miraculous way. For Amy, this meant giving up a work that she had to do, that of traveling with the missionary band, and instead settling in a small village in southern India and establishing the Donavur Fellowship to save and give a home to these children. That work continues today. The work, which is at its height, had 900 children to care for, and it proved the Tamil proverb, "Children tie the mother's feet." And so it was for Amy. She mixed formulas, washed diapers, whatever it took to do what the children needed. As she said, "I must have cut tens of thousands of tiny little toenails and fingernails." A woman who had had what is generally thought of as spiritual work, now doing all these mundane, menial, unnoticed tasks, for whom? It was for the Lord of the universe. And inasmuch as she did it for one of the least of these babies, she did it for Christ. Jesus shows us in this act that there are menial ways of taking up a cross. He did it because he knew his origin and his destiny. He calls us to do as he has done. Another example of this type of servanthood would be Mary, who willingly gave her body to the Lord. "Let it happen as you say," she said. "Behold the handmaiden of the Lord. Anything you say, Lord, I am at your orders." That is true servanthood. Visible signs of the invisible reality of a life completely abandoned to Jesus Christ. Sometimes I have the opportunity to speak to young people who are going out for either a summer mission program, a short term of 2 years or so. And when they ask me for advice, I say to them, if you find yourself on the mission field in a job that you didn't expect or that you were ever going to have to do, accept it as the will of God and remember that the servant is not greater than his Lord. When I'm asked to speak on the subject of leadership, my emphasis is on servanthood. We should not be seeking leadership. It is something that may be conferred upon us by a sovereign God. Our ambition should be to hear those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant," not "good and faithful CEO. Whatever God calls you to do, make sure that you know where you come from and where you are going. It's a very short segment that we have here on earth. We came from God. We are going to God. And this earth is the only place where we will have the opportunity to suffer. It is the only place where we have the opportunity to be perfected as a human being. The point is that God has given us trials and tribulations here. And if we reject them, we will not find the opportunity anywhere else. Say, as Mary said, "Behold the handmaiden of the Lord. Let it happen as you say." First of all, it means laying down the possibility of a different quality of life. It means denial, which is self-giving. The Apostle Paul said that he was willing to spend and to be spent. Another way of stating broken bread and poured out wine. Are we willing to sell all in order to buy the treasure in the field, the pearl of great price? Jesus said if we are not prepared to get rid of all our possessions, we cannot be his disciples. There were many hard words that Jesus spoke. It's amazing that the people followed him even as much as they did. Jesus said that it was for the loaves and fishes, mostly, that the multitudes followed him. But he asks us to sell all, to give up the right to ourselves, to forsake father, mother, family, possessions, home, and everything we have. And if we are not willing to do that, we are not qualified to be his disciples. Discipleship means not only laying down the possibility of a different quality of life and denial of myself, it means discipline. If you and I are to lead others to holiness, we must submit to God's discipline where it hurts the most. As someone has said, if you want to find out if you have a servant's heart, note your attitude when someone treats you like a servant. What is your response then? We get huffy and self-protective and irritated with anybody that might presume to treat us as a servant. A servant is one whose preferences are not necessarily honored. He is not asked what his agenda might be. He is told. It means work as well as discipline. And work is a privilege and a gift and a responsibility. St. Francis de Sales said, "The King of Glory rewards his servants not according to the dignity of the office, but according to the humility with which it is performed." The King of Glory rewards his servants not according to the dignity of the office, but according to the humility with which it is performed. Practicing the Presence of God is a little book about a monk who wanted to become a holy man, and so he went into the monastery to learn to be holy. He expected to be in a nice, quiet cell where he would meditate, contemplate, and pray. To his consternation, he was assigned to wash pots in the kitchen, and he didn't see how in the world he was ever going to become holy that way. Yet he began to practice the presence of God in the kitchen. There he was, racing around, undoubtedly sweating, in the hot kitchen of the monastery, subject to all kinds of demands from all kinds of people, running through the kitchen, asking for this and that and the other thing. And it was there that he began to learn to practice the presence of God. He learned to do his work for God. Undoubtedly, he was rewarded according to the humility with which it was performed. Well, it's a very delightful little book, and I hope you can find it somewhere. I have one on my shelf. I wonder how many of us have ever given thought to the simple and mundane routines of our lives as a daily offering to the Lord of the universe. There is no dichotomy between secular or non-spiritual and spiritual work. The leading of a Bible study or being the choir soloist is not more acceptable as an offering than when we stand at the stove preparing an evening meal for friends or for family. Each may be equally offered to God and acceptable in his sight, as Brother Lawrence learned. It means cooperation with God. It's an amazing privilege that you and I are given work to do, which is cooperation with God. Those who experience motherhood know that there is no greater example of cooperation with God than in bringing into this world another human being. He needs your body in order to do that. He doesn't create people any other way. He requires the cooperation of one woman and one man to bring that other child into the world. So we became, in this world, cooperators with him. And Lars and I were with my daughter and her family at Christmas time. She has 8 children. Thirdly, it may mean cooperation with God in ways which we never imagine he will ask of us. It requires restraint of emotions for the sake of others. In this day and age, we don't think much of people who restrain their emotions. They are in denial, or they're uptight, or they're fed up. But it's very clear from the scriptures that we are to restrain our emotions. We are to discipline ourselves. You don't let it all hang out. You don't stir up your emotions. You don't pour out all your troubles on somebody else's shoulder because they're already bearing burdens of their own. There's a sympathy and understanding which is permissible, but let it not be soupy or weakening. It means also that our gifts are at the disposal of a master. Perhaps your gifts have not been recognized. Perhaps they have not been asked for at all. Every one of us has a number of gifts, and it's quite impossible in this short life for us to exercise all the gifts that God has given us. People often remark, "Well, I don't have any gifts. You know, I was behind the door when the gifts were given out, so poor little me, I really can't do anything." And they're thinking, "I can't do what she does. I can't do what he does. I really can't serve the Lord." If the request comes and you can fill it, do so whether you sense that as being your gift or not. Otherwise, you may be as the lady who came back from the field feeling that she had been insulted by being asked to do something which was beneath her. Then we're not really prepared to be servants of Christ himself. How much scrutiny are you willing to endure? God might put you in a position where you are going to be scrutinized to your great discomfort. Will you accept that? Ad, my second husband, heard a woman say one time, "I work my fingers to the bone for this church, and what kind of thanks do I get?" And Ad felt like asking, "What kind of thanks did you expect? For whom do we do the job? Are you willing to do the job without receiving gratitude? Servanthood takes devotion, holy and humble in calling others to do as we have done. That is what one should aim for. That will inspire others to follow in your steps. Holy, humble in calling others, in setting an example, and asking nothing of them which we have not asked of ourselves. Amy Carmichael was very strong about that. She would not ask of anybody a job that she herself was not willing to do. When there was a cholera epidemic in the little village of Donavore, Amy took her pail of disinfectant and her rags and went down to those little huts in the village where nobody else could go, not even the doctors. She saved lives. I want to close with one of her poems for you to contemplate. Hast thou no scar, no hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thy bright ascendant star. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that follow me, but thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wound or scar? God bless you.
I pray you've been encouraged and inspired by what you've heard today. And will keep joining us here and on social media for My Granny's Inspiration. Until then, remember, the eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms.